Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Amy Bonifons, whose marvelous debut story collection is The Wrong Heaven. We'll also hear from Jillian Roger, author of Just One of the Boys, female-to-male cross-dressing on the American variety stage. Amy Bonifons is a rising star with one of the summer's hottest short fiction collections, The Wrong Heaven, soon to be followed by a novel about the afterlife called The Regrets. A New York native, she's speaking to us today from her home in Georgia, where she's studying for her PhD at the University of Georgia. Amy Bonifons, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this is one of those amazing story collections where the reader just wants to stay right inside the author's head. I mean, women become horses, lighted lawn ornaments start talking, people keep dead dogs in their freezers, little carved wooden figures come to life, and angels appear in unexpected places. Do you just amaze yourself sitting there making up these stories?
Sometimes it does kind of seem to come out of nowhere. I don't know where some of these things come from.
Well, I'm very curious to know if it starts with an image or just staring at the wall and thinking, what if you could take injections and become a horse?
Well, that one, it's funny you mentioned that one because that one has the clearest origin story of any of them. It actually came to me in a dream. It sounds cheesy, but it's true.
No.
I just woke up with this image of a woman injecting herself, and this sentence was in my head when I woke up, and the sentence was, "The opposite of having a baby is becoming a horse."
Yes.
And, yeah, there it was, the seed for that story. But some of the other ones, I'll just kind of start with a sentence, or I'll start with a kind of vague idea. Like, wouldn't it be funny to imagine how a dollhouse comes into being? Who's the person who makes all those little dolls? And what if that ended up being a metaphor for her own life? The angel of death came kind of from a Marie Howe poem, where she kind of personifies death as this sort of sexy man who seduces you. And I thought, you know, how interesting to imagine death that way. So they have really different origins.
And Horse is a story that had a life outside the book and was performed on This American Life. What was it like for you to hear that story come to life?
Oh my God, it was incredible. I really just wish every writer could have this experience of hearing amazing actors read your own words out loud. You know, because it was in somebody else's voice and also because it had been edited slightly, it didn't quite feel like mine. And I mean that in the best way possible. Like, I feel like I just heard my own story as my own ideal listener.
Of course, of course.
Yeah, it was wonderful. They did such an incredible job with it.
Now, while some of your stories are certainly ornamented with magical realism, others are firmly rooted in the real world, and I think of that story of two friends, Doris and Katie, who are older women, longtime friends. They're confronting the inevitable changes life brings, and relationships like that are never smooth. They almost always have some secrets and jealousies, and yet they manage to endure. That's a story that strikes me as somewhat different from the others in this book, and I wonder if you talk about writing that.
Yeah. That one's actually the oldest in the book, the first one that I wrote. It's almost 10 years old. And I wrote it after I had accompanied a friend to a doctor's appointment, luckily for something not as serious as Doris and Katie are dealing with. But it did get me kind of reflecting about just the things that friends go through together, and especially female friends. And you're right, those relationships can absolutely be so intense. I think sometimes more intense than romantic relationships. There's intimacies that build up over the years and secrets and resentments, and sometimes in a particular moment they can kind of sort of sharpen and rise to the surface the way that happens in the story. So I think that's what I was thinking about. And in a way, it comes full circle to Horse, which is the other story that's mainly about a female friendship, is the last story that I wrote right after reading those amazing Elena Ferrante novels about the long friendship between two women.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So that's a subject I continue to be interested in because it's such a force in my own life.
I love that last line, which woman was stopping the other from moving, which was holding the other up. I mean, that's such a moment of interdependence that we all face eventually. Alternate is another story that taps into something I think many folks are feeling these days. And the main character is an alternate for a dinner with Barack Obama. And when she doesn't get to go, she gets a consolation phone call. And she gets to ask him a pressing question. I wonder if you talk about writing that story, which is so rooted in right now, this moment.
Yeah, and that one was actually written, I don't remember the exact year, but it was during Obama's presidency. And it was at a time when I think I and other people I knew had felt so excited about voting for Barack Obama. And then, you know, at that particular moment in time, which now just in retrospect seems so quaint, we were feeling like, oh, this isn't quite the revolution we were hoping for, you know? And that's the moment that the characters find themselves in, both with respect to the, you know, their politics and their own personal lives. And, you know, looking back on it now and kind of editing it in preparation for publication from this particular moment, you know, I felt a wistfulness for that moment, which in retrospect seems so innocent, you know?
It does, yeah.
We've been through so much more since then. But I think what still feels true is this sense that we keep just holding out hope that our political life as a country will just allow us to be our best selves and to express the best potential that we have, you know, as people and as a country, and it keeps not happening in ways that are sometimes analogous to how we fail in our own personal lives, but the stakes are just so much bigger and the stakes feel so incredibly high now. I don't know, I don't think I'd be able to write that story now, but it does feel relevant.
Oh, yes.
In many ways, I think.
It is. Well, it made me think of that Joan Osborne song, you know, One of Us, What Would You Ask? What would you ask God if you had just one question?
Right.
And I think a lot of people go around thinking, well, if I could just talk to Barack Obama and ask him one question.
Oh, my goodness. And I think about that all the time now. I just wonder what he's thinking.
Yeah.
You know, and there's been some interviews with him, but you never know what's really going on. And yeah, I think about that all the time, actually.
Well, you described the feeling of hearing his voice over the phone quite beautifully.
Thank you.
Now, this is largely a collection about female desire, to be sure, and it's desire for many things. So I wonder if you'd talk about kind of staking that out as your subject.
Yeah, certainly. I think writing about desire, you know, just physical desire and sexuality was really important to me. There, you know, while there is some wonderful writing that deals with female sexuality and desire, I felt, you know, as a young reader, like there wasn't quite enough, and there wasn't quite enough that described my own experiences or resonated with them. So I think part of what I was trying to do was just truthfully describe not exactly the experiences I had. You know, there's not a one-to-one correspondence with any of it, but experiences that I, like the ones that I and my friends had, and just to be very honest about that. And I think that you're right, that it's not just like literal sexual desire. There's the desire for intimacy with female friends, as we mentioned. There's this desire for like a satisfying relationship to the body politic, and just a desire as a character in Horse Experiences for freedom and for a kind of wholeness and a kind of full autonomous selfhood that she hasn't been able to achieve in her own life. And I think one thing that I noticed as I was writing and rereading these stories was how so many of the characters seem to have a conflict between wanting freedom, or what they perceive as freedom, and wanting something that connects them to other people or to a larger collective, and that tension is kind of there in most of the stories.
Oh, yeah. Now, one of the things that strikes me so powerfully about this collection is that you've achieved that rare thing, that voice, and now I feel like I could read a short story of yours and I would recognize it immediately. And that's a considerable achievement. And I'm curious to know what voices have influenced you, what short stories you love.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a huge Haruki Murakami fan. he's probably not my number one favorite. I really love Miranda July and Amy Bender and Kelly Link. And I think you can probably see the influence of those there. There's many more. I did really love those Elena Ferrante stories, and I read those right before I wrote Force. Of course, many more I can say, but those are the ones that come to my mind as being most directly influential.
Oh, that's a great reading list. Now, one of the things that women desire in these books is, well, they desire things. Sometimes we all desire things. Uh-huh. And one of the greatest inventions you come up with here is aromatherapy that would define your life. Now, I really wish you could whisk some of that up and pass it around as you're out on tour.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Man. Anyway, well, and I loved Goddess Night. I love the unexpected things that happen when women get together. That I thought was a very wonderful short story.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Amy Bonifons, whose fabulous new story collection is The Wrong Heaven. You can meet her Tuesday, August 6th at 6 at the Garden District Bookshop. Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Susan. It was a pleasure.
I have got a sweetie known as Susie. In the words of Shakespeare, she's a wow.
Jillian Roger is a professor of musicology and ethnomusicology at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. She's also a part-time New Orleanian. She's the author of Champagne Charlie and Pretty Jemima, Variety Theater in the 19th Century. And today we're talking about her new book, Just One of the Boys, Female-to-Male Cross-Dressing on the American Variety Stage. Jillian, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
I've been hearing about this book for so long. I'm so happy it's finally here. And you just never know where research and scholarship will take you. And I especially love your story about the impetus for this book being a photograph of a woman dressed as a man. Describe that photograph for us.
So when I was in grad school, I happened to be doing a project and opened a book and found a photograph of a very dapper-looking young man, I thought, wearing essentially, it was like a morning coat, top hat, and the coat looked like it was a grey satin. It had a sort of shine to it. She had a waistcoat on. She had beautifully tailored pants. And I realized the longer I looked at it that, in fact, it wasn't a young boy. It was a she. It was a woman. The performer was Vesta Tilley. And it contradicted everything I thought I knew about Victorian England because she was an English performer. And that then launched one research project that spawned a second research project, which spawned essentially years and years and years of research that has resulted in this book.
That's a long and winding road.
Yeah,
yes.
It took about 30 years of research for this book to come to fruition.
So how did you first get interested in variety performers and performance?
Well, the variety performers, I didn't really know much about them except that I knew music hall performers because I'm just old enough to have been raised in Australia during the 1970s when I was not a child. I was actually old enough to really enjoy it. There was a revival of music hall in the 1970s in the English world. Mm-hmm. Part of that, I think, is that the music hall performers from the early 20th century were starting to die. And so the oldest of them, you know, they were looking at the end of the tradition. Mm-hmm. And everybody got very nostalgic about the Edwardian period and the Victorian music hall. And they had a show called The Good Old Days, which was a recreation of British music hall, including having a very verbose chairman, having young women singing over apparent gaslight footlights to an audience. Mm-hmm. It was just absolutely magical. having grown up in Australia, we still sang music hall songs. I mean, when we went on holiday with my family, we would be sitting in the car singing A Bicycle Built for Two, which is a very early 20th century song sung in music hall.
I do love that song.
Right. It's a beautiful song. Yeah. In fact, my second rabbit was called Daisy because of that song. So because of that, I have a link. I mean, I have a memory of these songs as actually performed mm-hmm. by the last generation of music hall performers, but also in revival. And I had a sense of how they worked, which gave me an advantage when it came to variety, partly because in America, it is a broken tradition. The last remnants of variety and vaudeville really live in television comedy,
right,
which is spoken, not sung. Popular music was basically moved on very fast. The song traditions died very quickly and were taken or eclipsed by syncopated singing and by jazz singing and the Great American Songbook and then by rock and roll. Mm-hmm. But the comedic traditions survive. But if you want to understand 19th century performance, you have to know the song traditions. And those song traditions were English song traditions that crossed backwards and forwards across the Atlantic. The same songs were in both countries.
Now, one of the things you make clear is what a challenging life this was mm-hmm. for these women to conduct and for all variety performers. I mean, it's financially precarious to start with.
Mm-hmm. If you wanted to have stability, early on you would join a stock company, which meant that you were resident in one town, usually for a season, which is about October through March. You might get renewed for the next year where you could stay there or at least come back because you work over the summer, but you work traveling over the summer. Mm-hmm. So what happened was that those people were paid less, but they had some stability. They could raise a family, they could live in a community. But if you wanted to earn the big bucks, you had to be on the road and you played a new town every week or 2 weeks. Sometimes you might get a month and you just moved. Sunday was travel day. You got on a train and you went to the next place you were going to and you never had any kind of stability.
And rare indeed was the woman who became the manager of her own career.
It was almost impossible for women to be fully autonomous, even in the theatrical world. And that was a place where they had the most autonomy of almost anywhere, as far as I can tell. Mm-hmm. They were paid quite a lot, but it was hard to succeed without male patronage. So you needed to have managers who were willing to hire you, willing to work with you. You had to have a male agent who helped grease the wheels and get you bookings out in advance. There were very few female managers, and those who ended up in that position often didn't last more than a season or two. They often had very bad reputations so that they would be decried in the theatrical trade papers as being people who were indecent. And I suspect that it was male managers felt a certain level of unease at women entering that level of the profession. So mm-hmm. women were absolutely accepted as stars. People made lots and lots of money on these women. They paid these women handsomely. But a woman without some kind of male patronage was seen as not entirely trustworthy.
And then over time, they had to develop a personal style that would appeal to an audience and could be reviewed so the word would be spread. And then there was finding material, which mm-hmm. is so interesting because, you know, some people had distinctive songs that they hung on to and would not share with other artists.
So in the United States, that's less the case than it was in England. In England, mm-hmm. they absolutely had a sort of propriety over their repertory, and they would warn people against singing it. In the United States, because it was such a big country, because there was so much performance everywhere, it was a little harder to police that, although every now and then you would see a warning saying, "We are singing these songs, don't sing them." Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you would also see lots and lots of songs with very similar titles, which makes me think that performers were capitalizing on somebody else's success. So, for example, in the 1870s, there was a song, it was had a tagline, like the last line of the chorus was, "Pull down your vest." I have no idea what this song was about. I found it half a dozen versions of it easily. And I think that what happened was that people would write their own and they would say the famous song, Pull Down Your Vest. And because they'd seen people having success with a song with that title in other places. And so these multiple versions or multiple songs with similar content would spread through the profession as they saw reviews in the trade newspapers that somebody else was having success with it.
Now, this is very painstaking research. I mean, you're looking at theater reviews in newspapers, advertisements, traveling around to theater archives. And you've spent 30 years, as you say, in this area. So what are the implications that are useful to us today? Why do we need to know this?
I think we need to know this partly because, well, there's a few reasons. First of all, Variety entertainment was not really recognized as having existed. People know about vaudeville, but they don't know about what came before vaudeville. And our memory of vaudeville is shaped by the children who were active in it right at the end of the vaudeville tradition. So we have stories, we have documentaries about vaudeville, but it really only shows the last part of that history. We also have vaudeville history that relies very heavily on records from one circuit. So we don't know about everything else. We don't know about how they got there. We just get told it was invented by somebody. And part of the reason that I started doing this was that I was pretty sure that this one person didn't invent everything. And I couldn't say he was wrong. Because that doesn't get you anywhere in scholarship. All I could do was prove that the things that he claimed to have invented actually predate him. Mm-hmm. The other thing was that when I looked at theatrical records in the early 20th century, I could make no sense of them against the history. So I thought, let's go back to a point where the history doesn't cover and just write it from scratch. So that's important in that it shows us the institutions that we have often weren't made from scratch. They often are based on things that happened before. You need to know the things that shape those earlier forms in order to understand how things continue to develop. Second thing is that this is working class history.
Right.
And it's working class culture, which is too often treated in scholarship as though it's a pale and inadequate copy of middle class culture. And what I'm trying to do is show that it is its own thing with its own values, that it reflects the life of these people who are often not very prominent in the historical record because they don't leave very much behind.
And how we seek pleasure reveals so much about ourselves.
Well, the scholarship reflects the moral reform writing of the 19th century that depicts poor people who seek pleasure as immoral because they're poor, so that they don't have the sense not to waste money on pleasure. And I would like to argue that everybody has a right to pleasure and that this is not about immorality and a lack of hard work and all of these things that we still see aimed at poor people. This is about how do they imagine their world? How do they imagine a way to shift their world? So it's about their hopes, their dreams, and their realities as reflected in popular culture. And in the same way that if I want to know about segments of the population now, I will often go to the popular culture to see how they're expressing themselves. We can do the same in the past.
And New Orleans is a part of the story as well. New Orleans was a big stop on the circuit,
wasn't
it?
Oh, New Orleans was always an important theatrical city because this is a place that had a great love of theater. And you find, particularly once the St. Charles Theatre was opened, which really was the big rival on the American side of town to the French Opera House. So the St. Charles Avenue Theatre was the premier spot to play in the South, really. There was people stopping here really before they went anywhere else. Really, the only other city beyond New Orleans was Galveston.
I know. I was so surprised to see that.
Well,
yes.
But for that hurricane at the early 20th
1900,
century.
Yes.
Galveston, it was a major theatrical city. So the Gulf is important with those two cities as big theatrical stops. Really, you go New Orleans, Memphis, St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And those were all on the Spalding Bidwell circuit, which was a circuit that ran really up and down the Mississippi and then into the southern states. But there weren't major stops on it beyond Galveston and New Orleans.
And you also mention somewhat Lydia Thompson, who has a very special role in New Orleans history.
Which I have discovered. I knew nothing about this. You know, I actually looked up that song because I can't say I have gone to Rex. I don't get down here for Mardi Gras most of the time.
Well, we should say the song is If Ever I Cease to Love.
Right. So that song is absolutely fascinating. First of all, it seems to be bigger here than the song would justify. It wasn't a particularly important song. It wasn't one that's well known elsewhere. I look for copies of it, and it doesn't come in a lot of versions. What's interesting about it was that it was written by George Laybourne, who was what we know as a lion comique. These were male comedians who did comedy through song in England, and they were the men that a lot of the early male impersonators parodied, copied, so that it's not uncommon for them to take on their repertory. I'm not sure whether or not to believe the stories that she'd heard Laybourne sing the song, because the person who did the show, it was in her show Bluebeard, which was a burlesque. And Michael Connolly did the music for that, and he was very adept at taking popular song of the time and working it in. So it may have been him, may have been her. Certainly it was popular enough that a couple of American singers, male comic singers, had taken it as part of their repertory. But it wasn't like Champagne Charlie, which everybody sang.
Yeah.
But it seemed to have taken down here and caught the imagination. It's full of silliness and sort of wonderful, very punny 19th century humor.
That's funny images. And we love our romances, Grand Duke Alexis and Lydia Thompson and all that.
So. Well, of course, there is some rumor that he was actually after Lotta Crabtree at the time.
Scandal. Oh, we've been talking with Jillian Roger, whose fascinating new book is Just One of the Boys, Female to Male Cross-Dressing on the American Stage. Jillian, thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Historian Carolyn Cobb discusses the history of hurricanes, Wednesday, August 1st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Justin Nystrom discusses and signs his new book, Creole Italian, Sicilian Immigrants and the Shaping of New Orleans Food Culture, Thursday, August 2nd at 6 at Octavia Books. Kimberla Lawson Roby discusses Better Late Than Never, the final book in her Curtis Black series, Thursday, August 2nd at 6 at the Magnolia Pavilion Theater at Baton Rouge Community College, sponsored by Between the Lines Bookstore. The East Bank Regional Library in Metairie presents the Tricentennial Literary Festival, 300 Years of Literature, Saturday, August 4th at the library. I'll kick things off with some thoughts on New Orleans writing. Historian Patricia Brady talks about the role of such outsiders as Lafcadio Hearn and Francis Parkinson Kise. That's at 11, followed by Emily Toth presenting Kate Chopin's Secrets at 12:30. The event concludes with cookbook author Cynthia Lejeune Nobles on Ignatius J. Riley, A Very Lucky Dog, at 2. Amy Bonifance discusses and signs The Wrong Heaven, Tuesday, August 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.